the audio at the moment. Before we get stuck into the interview and I get into the questions, just so I've got it on the record, would I be able to grab your full name and official title, please?
Yeah, so Dan, D-A-N. And would you like a surname or?
Yeah, full, like full name, full.
Yeah, Dan Nicolau, so N-I-C-O-L-A-U. And professor, professor or doctor, whatever you like, or just Dan.
Well, we'll sort of run through it all and we'll go from there. Now, Dan, there has been some news coming out on your end that there's been a new model of creation, sort of mapping how the COVID-19 spread has gone around sort of the world. You've got data from all different points around the globe. Would you sort of be able to walk me through, first and foremost, how the data for this model came about and where you sourced it from?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for the question and thank you for the interview. So we looked at lots of other models, and mostly they're of the epidemiological type. So they basically make assumptions about parameters like how infective something is and how many people other people are in touch with and things like that, and then sort of try to project forward. Those models are very sophisticated, but they have to make lots of assumptions. And because it's a new virus, it's very difficult to know. So they have to make lots of assumptions. And the result is that the predictions that they make are very broad. So they'll say anything between, you know, total catastrophe to quite an optimistic situation. What we wanted to do is get away from having to make assumptions because this is a very uncertain situation, and we wanted to rely on more on firmer stuff. So we looked at actual data. We looked at actual reported number of cases, number of recoveries, and number of deaths, and we have data for every country. We get it from a couple of different sources, but importantly from Johns Hopkins in the US, who keep a very good database of the reports coming in for every country. And then what we kind of started with as a premise is that most people who get COVID-19 will recover, the vast majority. And so that means that the number of cases divided by the number of recoveries over a long time, like months, will go to one because almost everybody recovered. So that means when that curve is going up, that more people are getting sick than are getting better, so things are getting worse. And once that turns around and it starts going down, that means that more people are recovering than are getting sick, so things are getting better. When that curve starts to head towards one, when it starts to get to about two or three, and it's on its way down, that sort of means things are getting better. And if you look at countries that have got this under control, like South Korea, China, and in fact, Australia, you can see that pattern. It turns out that that pattern is repeated in pretty much every country, and that it precedes the peak of maximum death per day by about 4 weeks. And that, again, seems to be a pattern that's happening everywhere. And that's the basis of our model.
So it's sort of trying to move away from a predictive model like there have been in the past to one that's a little bit more concrete, a little bit more, I suppose the better word to say, is definite. Is this something that we can see as a... So it's rather than being a predictive model, you're looking at tracking the graph thus far?
So it's a predictive model, but of a different kind. If I can give you an analogy, and it's an imperfect analogy, of course. One way you could think about predicting the weather is to try to think about the equations that govern the weather. So the pressure front, things like temperature effects on where air is moving and things like that. And of course, those are very sophisticated, but they also involve a lot of assumptions about how things work. Another way you could predict the weather is simply have lots of weather stations around and just see what's been happening to the temperature for the last few days, or what's been happening to the rain for the last few days, and say, well, you know, it's been getting warmer for the last 3-4 weeks, so it's likely to get warmer for another couple of weeks. And that's a different way to think about forecasting. So our model is predictive in the sense that it makes forecasts, but it just tries to get away from mathematical assumptions about epidemiological factors, partially because we just don't know those numbers. And if you look at the models out there that are based on that, they predict very, very wide ranges of things. So they are interesting, but perhaps not useful in terms of what we want to know is what's likely to happen in 2 weeks or a month. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, definitely. So you're changing the model and sort of the base of your data from an assumptive one to sort of more facts. I think the weather analogy works out rather well. You can kind of base what's going to be coming on what's already happened. Now that this model has been out, and I know that there is a daily updated COVID wave site, what kind of implementation and adaption would you like to see from this model that's out there? Obviously, we are sort of right in the middle, or some would even say we're on the outward trajectory and sort of easing off all the cases and everything that's going on. So it's going to be finishing up sometime soon. What kind of implementation or adaption of this new model can we expect to see? Is it going to be one that sort of helps finalize and finally get rid of the current infection?
You know, if you look at those curves, and we have data for something like 170 countries in there, what's really, really striking and surprised even us, that we were hoping for this, but it really was a surprise how precise this is. It's very similar patterns happening in virtually everywhere. So whether Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, countries with a lot of money, countries with very high densities of people, countries with very low densities of people, pretty much the same pattern is happening virtually everywhere, but at different epochs, what we call in epidemiology epochs, at different times. So it's kind of like a movie, but it starts at different points in the film. So that means that the response, the adaption, to borrow your word, kind of has to be tailored to where every country is in its own stage. And if you look at the world picture, the world itself can be treated as like one large country, and it is itself at a particular stage. It's going through a second wave, which is now resolving. So I think those kinds of decisions, you know, it depends on who you are. But if you are Australia, which we are, then we really are far into the recovery curve, and we really aren't reporting very many new infections. We really aren't reporting almost any deaths, and the numbers are very low. So it's certainly, you know, from the point of view of the modeling, this would be a time to think very seriously about a disciplined return to some sort of normality, gradually, of course, and intelligently. But this would be a time to think about that. If you're somewhere like India, where things are getting worse, the US, where things are probably peaking, but it would take a long time for them to get better, somewhere like the UK, where they probably are getting better, but again, a little bit behind, where something like, say, Australia or New Zealand are, you know, they would be at an earlier stage. So that should inform their decision. But the point is that these countries all are at different stages of the same pattern. I hope that makes sense as an answer.
It does. And it might be a little bit out of your ballpark, but given the evidence that the model that you've created has sort of put forward and given you, what kind of steps would be best to be taken for an intelligent return to normality?
You know, I think those are very difficult questions to answer, because they involve lots of things like economic considerations, lives saved, healthcare resources, and many other factors. But one thing that you could think about that sort of unifies those is that the infectivity is not a constant thing. So it isn't the case that two people sitting together in a park are as likely to cause as much damage in terms of the pandemic as, say, 40,000 people going to a football game, or 1,000 people going to like a very large outdoor area being in very close contact. The distribution of infectivity is extremely broad and it has a very long tail. You can kind of think of it as like an animal with like a very, very, very long tail, like a possum. And it's really the infective events at the end of that tail, the like concert, loads of people in very, very close quarters, that cause a lot of the infections to get passed around. So you could keep the lid down on those things. You could think about not, you know, letting concert venues open for like quite a long time, not letting very large venues open for quite a long time. But you could certainly think about having spaced out restaurants open. You could think about bars with limited numbers of people in them. You could certainly think about workplaces where there are not very many people going into that workplace. And something like what Sweden has tried to do, you know, just be reasonable about it. And as long as people are far enough apart on average, you can catch most of the events where someone's passing an infection, but still return a lot of the public to something approximating, you know, where we were a few months ago, and then take the lid off really slowly to make sure there's no rebound second wave.
So from what I can gather there, the infection is sort of tapering off. The amount of new cases and everything is, like we said, tailing off. So it'll just be a case of maintaining the current restrictions, easing them off slightly as that infection rate gets lower and lower.
Yeah, although we have no firm answers, but I think what you're describing is broadly a reasonable approach on the basis of our modeling. Of course, authorities have to weigh lots of different things up in making decisions, but in terms of where the curves are going, this would sort of be a good time in countries where, you know, that curve is really heading down and there aren't that many new cases and there is no evidence that there are many new infection clusters active. It seems like one could begin to think about in the not too distant future, something like May, lifting some of the restrictions, some of the gentler ones.
And we are rolling again. Now, this is a contentious thing that I sort of mentioned briefly when we had a chat earlier on before we jumped on the line. I came across a report that said something like $340-ish million was cut to university research funding in the 2019-2020 budget. And with this modelling coming out of QUT predominantly, is it something that, is this event and this research in particular something that sort of places a high value and a high importance on continuing the research funding?
Thank you for the question. I think you can think about this stuff at two or three different levels, sort of like an airplane at 30,000 feet, 10,000 feet, and 1,000 feet. At a very, very high level, of course, it's vital that every country invests more in research, and it's vital that Australia invests as much as possible because we have the capability, we have the people, we have the tech, and we also have the problems. We have problems like bushfires, we have problems like global warming that really require research. So I think the answer is always that we should be increasing research funding. And whenever I hear something about funding being cut, I always kind of raise an eyebrow, as most of my colleagues would. My own personal story is that I'm very well supported by the Australian Research Council, and I'm very lucky that Australia supports my research very strongly. In fact, this is what brought me from Oxford to Australia. Now, in terms of where we kind of are in relation to other nations, I would know that Australia has something like 7 universities in the top 100 in the world, which is off the charts great, considering how few of us there are. And I think it would be a great pity to jeopardize that sort of extremely privileged position that we have worked for many decades to build. And the only way to really prop up and improve, you know, that kind of research standing, and we really do have, we punch far above our weight, is to continue to not only to continue the research funding level that we have now, but to increase them aggressively and wherever we can, particularly in key areas like mathematics, like engineering, like medicine. So I hope that is a fair and balanced answer, and I agree it is a contentious topic.
Wonderful. Well, Dan, thank you very much for taking some time out and having a chat to us today. It is modelling, which is a pretty positive outlook as well, seeing as that the curve is flattening off and it's going to be a long tail before we see the end of this infection. Before I let you go this afternoon, was there anything else that you wanted to add or anything that we may have missed during our chat that you'd like to cover?
In a special, but if you look back through history at things like this, like the Spanish flu, like the plague, and lots of other things, what you see is that basically we make it. There are very tragic outcomes, and there are periods of hardship across the world, and you know, it's not a nice part of life. But in every case, looking back, essentially the progress of humanity is more or less untouched, and in most cases slightly perhaps enhanced overall by things like this, because we learn from our mistakes and we get better at managing things in the future. So although, you know, if you watch the news, especially the TV, I think you can get an idea that things are really, really going in a very, very bad direction for the world and for individual countries. But I suspect, you know, if history is a guide, looking back next year, we'll say, you know, it was a bad year and lots of bad things happened. But basically, humanity's fine and we'll learn and we'll be better at the next challenge.